I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is the technology radio show, GeekSpeak. Today's title is Go Modem Divides FBI into Two Factors. Hello, you're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is programmer and father and political aficionado, Mr. Miles Elam. Hey, Miles.
Hey, that's aficionado.
How'd I say it?
Aficionado, or I actually have no idea what you were
saying. No, I always mess up that word. I don't know why that is.
Aficionado, which makes me the pedant.
That's right. Maybe I intentionally messed up so you'd be a pedant.
Right, out of myself? Yeah, thanks.
Hey, why don't we talk about artificial intelligence versus artificial intelligence?
Yes, in the past, we talked about how with AI, AI called DeepMind, it had beaten Grand Champion and Go players.
Oh, yeah, Go, the really complicated game.
Right.
More moves than chess and the whole deal, right?
Far more.
Yeah.
That you can't hold all of the possible moves in Go in memory. There's not enough storage for a computer that is smaller than a planet.
You mean like a simplistic way of solving chess is to go ahead and map all possible moves from every position and then look at the scope of the best possibles and then choose
or at least
way.
Get very close to it. Yeah. Checkers, you can map every possible move and just have it in memory. So
like,
there is absolutely...
Like tic-tac-toe.
Yes. It's like tic-tac-toe, only...
a little bigger.
Yeah.
But Go is so large of a possibility set that you can't do a memory map thing. So it has to be done in another way, which makes it a more complicated problem than chess.
Right.
And we're simplifying this, of course.
Right. And so the AI is looking at general patterns and strategies rather than a just fixed set of moves.
Yeah.
What they've done, however, is not rest on their laurels, but create a whole new AI that's self-taught. And it is doing so much better at the game than the one that was taught by humans. When it was just taught by humans putting in some basic rules and the like, it got to the point where it could beat every possible human player.
Mm-hmm. Wait, are you saying that the rule set for this new AI, the actual instructions of programming the AI was by another AI?
Yes.
I thought it was just you take two AIs, you just have them battle each other and hope that, you know, no thermonuclear war. But what you're saying is that is actually the algorithm itself that came up with it was created by another process.
Yes.
Isn't this
a self-taught
thing?
Yeah, a self-taught AI.
Isn't that like in Terminator when they said that? You went, oh, like you got the spine tingling? That's the defect. Okay. And so it's much better than humans.
Yes. Now, when you say much better, you kind of have this, well, it was already beating every human player.
Now it does it cocky.
Yeah, this reminds me very much of the movie Automaton. I actually don't remember if it was on, it used to be on Netflix, I think now it was just on some random channel, I happened to catch it, and Antonio Banderas stars in it. And the idea is that they had made robots that could learn, and so they had this what they call a biochip that was learning and then giving a feedback loop to itself so it would learn some more and it would ask questions and it would answer, and they were saying that it was just learning at such a tremendous pace that after 8 days it stopped communicating, and they're like, why did it stop? It's like, no, it didn't stop talking. We just couldn't understand what it was saying anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's what this kind of reminds me of, is we have no idea really how it works.
Wait, we don't know how this application works.
Most high-level AI nowadays, the people who have programmed it don't necessarily know all the rule set. They don't know the paths that it's taken in there. It's just you put in some parameters, you say what your optimal output is going to be, and it works it out through several generations.
Right.
And so when you say, how does it actually do this? Why did it make that particular decision? Even the people who were in charge of making it were like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Just how it worked out. And this feels very much like that, where now when you have these AI for very complex things, because Go was kind of, in terms of the person-to-person games,
mm-hmm.
it was about at the height. I don't know of any other ones that are the next level, because there was always, you know, we have checkers. Oh, but you haven't done chess yet. Oh, you've done chess. Oh, but you haven't done Go yet. Well, now you've done Go. What other
human manipulation?
Yeah, now you're at the point where you're talking about Turing test.
Yeah.
Where
that's a different scope, though. I mean, that really is a different level of solution space. I mean, in the sense that general knowledge is just a very different gambit.
But this isn't necessarily general knowledge. This is, can you give back a response that a human being will accept as being from another human being?
No, I get that. I mean, I think what I'm saying is, you know, the Jeopardy win is, I would say, in some ways more important than the Go strategy win, in the sense that that's closer to Turing space. But
I actually disagree with that.
You think being able to play Go really well is closer to being
having
a human
something
than?
Like the Watson for Jeopardy,
mm-hmm.
Where you put in a whole bunch of disparate information and you link them together through various ontologies. Seems like that was what we had been doing already. We just increased the amount of
processing
of data.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems very much in line with what you see with Google when you say name of the actor who starred in X and X. And that gives that answer. It's tying these ontologies together.
I guess my point about general.
But with Go, you don't have the rules. With Go, you have here's the general problem you need to solve. Mm-hmm. Now get there somehow, but you can't have the entire problem space in memory.
I guess what I'm saying is that the rule set for Go is so minuscule. It's a complicated memory, you know, it's a memory hard problem, but it's not a complicated rule set. Unlike human language is a complicated rule set. So that's why I'm saying it's a different type of problem space. And when thinking about how you interact with the world, you have to have a large understanding of general knowledge that is more Watson-like than Go winning-like.
That general knowledge that Watson has, though, is above and beyond what most human beings have. If you're working on the rule set
of
Jeopardy.
But at the same time, not. The interconnections of the world that we know, that we learn as a child, and how we interact, that when we bump into something, we figure out how to walk slowly. Sure, we have walking robots now that have done that. And then at the same time, learning the language of our parents and understanding emotional intent and understanding how humans are different than animals. And I mean, go on and on and on. The problem scope of becoming an intelligent human is such a large problem and requires so much general knowledge that the Go algorithm is not going to be able to do.
But you're talking about how a human being comes to learn these things.
The general understanding, though, is a general artificial intelligence will have to learn at some way the same they'll have to have feedback loops, like the Go program has, right?
Yes,
it has general patterns and flow. We can't isolate all of the possible rules of general intelligence.
Right, but it doesn't have to. It only has to have one rule.
What's
and
one
do
rule?
Variations on that one rule. Do I get a beneficial response from the human? That's it. So if it uses one combination,
yeah,
it doesn't have to have any knowledge about how it works, though.
Miles, knowing how many squares on a Go board and get the biggest value is an extremely simple goal compared to, do I get a beneficial response from a human? What's a beneficial response from a human? A smile? No. I mean, the problem target
if the user
is
says,
too large.
Oh, computer, that's a fail. So it tries another combination.
Yeah, so
oh,
then you're talking about having a human actually interact and have a judgment place. That means a human training. We don't train humans to be humans. We let them explore the world and it's not a training. You don't have an automatic.
You're basically saying that culture doesn't exist. Because
I'm not saying that.
We absolutely train human beings.
Training is about defining the rule set. We don't define the rule set of our culture. We have culture, but we don't define it. We are in it. You and I can't raise a human by only us giving the inputs to them. We have to let them be in the world. It's too large a problem space for us to translate into a rule set. Except that we do it by our language and our how you interact. You have to have an embodiment. You have to have a body to do that kind of thing.
Yes, but our kids, when they're growing up, they are getting feedback from us going like, I don't like that result.
Yes, but that requires embodiment. That requires everything it is to be a human, including a physical form. And it has to be learning general knowledge, learning basic rules of the world very slowly from the ground up. It's not the same as a very simple target.
I might have agreed with you up until I saw something like the AI that was learning how to jump over an obstacle.
That was a good example of a close, yeah, I mean, something that's more human-like.
And that, I believe, is very similar to the type of problem that this Go AI was doing.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Look, motion and space stuff, in some ways, we're going to get creatures, artificial creatures to be able to do those things relatively soon. We're already doing it, right? But when you're dealing with the social interactions of human beings, you've got to produce a body and engage in that space. And it's just a different kind of training exercise, if you will. But in any case,
I still think you take two arbitrary human beings and you have them talk to each other through a terminal. I don't believe that that is terribly complex in most cases.
Then you don't understand the problem.
Because they don't know. If you don't have context about each other, you have a more limited subset.
For 60 years, people have been trying to do this.
Yes.
It is a problem. It is a hard problem.
No, I'm not saying it isn't a hard problem. But then again, we have advances right now, like Go, like
yes.
The jump over an obstacle without teaching you what an obstacle is, just
yes.
How do you get it to work, that we are accelerating rapidly.
But by the way, the reference that Miles is talking about regarding the robot teaching it to walk in an artificial environment, giving physics, basically, and the ability to make joints and muscle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
A robot was able to figure out how to have movement and even bipedal movement and then get over obstacles like jumping and stuff. And the thing that's creepy about watching the rendering of this files is it's very much the uncanny valley in the way it moves. It feels like a zombie moving. You're like, oh, that's wrong. But it gets around.
Right. At the very beginning, as it goes further and further, it becomes more and more natural.
I would say more and more uncanny valley. I haven't seen anything natural yet. Maybe I've only seen the earlier footage.
Yeah, I thought the earlier stuff was very robotic, and then it started hitting the uncanny valley. And then I started noticing something that I felt like, this is actually starting to move closer and closer.
Please define the uncanny valley.
Uncanny valley being this effect that we perceive as humans, where if something is totally unlike a human, our typical robots from the 1980s, that moved very walked with a staccato, I guess is the best way I can mm-hmm. describe it. And you're just like, oh, yeah, that's a robot. Once you got the robot to the point where it started getting very close to human beings, but there was just something a little bit off, that ended up being crossing over into the creepy. Our brains just like something switches, and you go, That's no longer just clumsy. That's creepy. And it's kind of what we think of when we say a zombie. A zombie walks like a human, only just enough off that we go, something is wrong.
Yeah, in general, the valley, the uncanny valley, is because you can take a creature that is kind of humanoid and make it more and more and more. And so it's a line that's kind of linear going up, being more and more human, more and more human, more and more human. And at one point, it gets to less and less human because it got into a pivot point where it becomes like the slope changed to a valley.
And a pivot point of human perception, yeah.
Yeah, and pretty soon it's in this place. And a good example of this is that some people had this feeling with the what was the name of that movie about the train? It was a Christmas movie.
Oh, yeah, the Polar Express.
Polar Express. Some people had that feeling about Polar Express, that it was not real, but not
where
fake.
Tom Hanks played every character.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm I'll link to it up on the show page, the Uncanny Valley. Okay, so what you're saying is artificial intelligence, like fully general purpose artificial intelligence is just around the corner, just because we could
Something that can pass the Turing test, especially if it's on a text-based medium.
Yeah. So passing the Turing test right now shouldn't really be that big of a problem because there is such a large dialogue online to come from. I don't think passing the Turing test is really that big a deal.
Well, we haven't done it yet, so it's still kind of a big deal if we can get to
depends
that point.
It depends on the viewer. I could pick a group of 50 people, and they would fail the Turing test. It's true, right? I mean, you could find some people that are not very savvy in the idea of it, not how to have a conversation, and maybe have a lower general IQ, and you sit them down and have them talk to a terminal, and Deep Blue could probably do it. So the Turing test is about how well it does at some level.
Yeah.
Any case, let's move on. I want to tell you about this ridiculously fun story about a developer who was doing some coding, and the job that they were at did not allow the computer that was running Windows development environment to be online. But this was really kind of affecting the developer's work. And it was a security issue, right? Don't let the computer online that's got source code on it, but go ahead and develop on that machine. But this developer, as most of us do, really wanted to use references all the time. So copy and pasting some code or looking at something and having it accessible. So they also had a laptop in the work environment that did have network. So laptop with internet access to be able to get information and documentation and things like that. And then machine completely isolated from the network. But they noticed that the machine that was completely isolated from the network did have an audio in and out. And the laptop had an audio in and out. And so they decided to use audio as the communication mechanism between these two machines.
They decided to create a network connection just through a different means. In other words, circumvent the security protections of having an air-gapped computer.
Right. And they used web audio. Web audio is one of the standards of the web and allows you to play audio through JavaScript means and control it and actually generate sounds and all that. And the project is called Web Audio Modem, and you can download the source code and use it yourself if you'd like, if you know how to program a bit. The general process is you plug two computers in, and one machine, you take text and you spit into the modem situation. It makes sounds out of its speaker, and the other machine listens to that and takes those sounds and translates it back into text, effectively doing a
It's the 1970s all over again.
All over again. Anyway, first off, bad. Don't do that. The reason the protocols are in place is a good reason. Either you're breaking the efficiency of your programmers by making them have an air gap, if you will, and that's wrong, or they have really good reason to do that and don't circumvent the system like this. But it's a very interesting story, a really fun write-up about how it was done, and of course all the source code at GitHub, including a live demo, so you can kind of listen on how it works and such.
So what was the speed at? Was it like a 300 baud?
It's definitely slow. Let's go ahead and we'll do an encoder, and we'll say, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hopefully your volume's turned down.
No, we're going to get it nice and loud. Let's see if it works. That was welcome.
That is
big.
Very low. That,
that's
yeah,
a
that...
low baud rate.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that was just, you can actually speed it up. So if you can, you know, make the whole thing go a lot faster, and you can reduce the pauses between things. So now we're up at a bit high duration of 950 milliseconds and a pause between bytes of 10 milliseconds. Oh, sorry, slower. And of course, I can't stop it. Okay, reload the page. Anyway, kind of a fun project. I think it's kind of lovely using something like that. Let's move on to your next story, which of course is about how Silicon Valley divided society and made everyone really mad.
Well, this is a story from Newsweek. And of course, it's an editorial. It's going to have its proponents and detractors. Mm-hmm. But it did bring forth what I thought was a very interesting idea. This coming from you and I being from the coming of age in the dot-com boom, or at least being in our mid-20s in the dot-com boom. And during that time, during the time of the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, there was very much this is going to change everything. It's going to democratize everything. There was a great amount of optimism associated with all the good things that the internet's going to do, and
this radio program was born at that time, right?
Yeah, it's going to slice your bread for you, and after the dot-com bust, and after time went on, found like, oh, many of the same things that are in society that, you know, income inequality or something, those are still there. They're still
corporate greed there. And
keeping people away from information or ownership of of items. Not all information became free, like some people were saying. Information wants to be free. Well, apparently a lot of it doesn't because it's still under copyright, and we put in a lot of controls to make sure you could have a
it's so funny.
DMCA takedown request.
This narrative sounds very reminiscent of the 1960s to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, there was a revolution of ideas and a flourishing of love and respect and the idea of getting rid of, you know, war and actually achieving that at some level for a period of time. And then you look back going, what happened? And that's kind of the I'm assuming the guts of the story is what happened with Silicon Valley?
Well, the story here is talking about how in 2010, you had Facebook. And people were sharing stuff, and you'd have the occasional news story on there, but most people were sharing photos of family or, you know, talking about whatever. And just before then, you had, you know, MySpace was dying and or playing audio that you couldn't really turn off easily from everyone's homepage, stuff like that. And it was just seen as like, hey, this is a new way for people to communicate. And then people started thinking, well, it's a new way for people to get ads out there and get actual data based on it. And we're going to give people ads that are tailored to them, what they actually want, instead of bothering them with stuff they don't want. That we're going to give them just the information that they're looking for. We're going to tailor that so they get exactly what they didn't even know they want yet. Fast forward to 2015, 2016 election year, and you have tampering from outside powers to try to divide the U.S.
using the Facebook, right? Using new systems of the Silicon Valley,
right? And you have the rise of the alt-right who use technology for spreading a message which was commonly seen as fringe, but was given a much larger microphone,
mm-hmm.
and then a much larger following, or at least people coming out of the woodwork.
It's interesting. I mean, for years, you know, we kind of joked about how wonderful different online communities are, because people that are really interested in, you know, painting lead figures, all of a sudden they can find other people that are interested in painting lead figures, or people that are really interested in, you know, a certain color can find photos of that color.
Yeah, it's unicorns that fart rainbows.
Right. So like every kind of niche that's small has a larger joined force of voice on the internet. And of course, now we see also the downside of that.
Right. And so this is this curious thing of what role does Silicon Valley have, especially because it had or still has such a strong self-image of we are changing the world and we're going to make everything better and we're going to take all the things that are really inefficient, we're going to make them efficient, and we're going to...
Do you think that that actually really existed in Silicon Valley?
Oh, absolutely.
Why?
That was absolutely the ethos behind Uber, to say taxis are totally this cartel, we're going to go in, we're going to democratize it, anyone can come in and become a driver.
I don't think so. I think that the people that are outspoken and optimistic and are heard feel that way. And then I think there's people that are really good at business that don't give a crap and figure out the best way to make money on the internet. And those people are the ones that are in control. But you worked for like Google, and did you think that do you think that the heads of Google were really righteous people, or do you think they were just had good ideas and were going to make a big business? What's your real thought on that?
I think that there was an optimism there, but I also think that this is true of Google, also true of a lot of tech companies. I believe that they came in, they ran into a wall, which was they were treating a lot of the technical problems as technical problems, when in fact many of them were turning into, when you get into the large, into a social problem, a person problem, interactions. And your fixation on trying to solve something as a technical issue falls flat when you ignore the social sciences, which by and large tech companies have done. And all that research that people have done in psychology and sociology and anthropology, it was basically put by the wayside as people went like, oh, we're just going to put this into an algorithm. The algorithm is going to be so elegant and it's going to just work because it's logical, and So the outcome will be logical, except that human beings aren't logical, mm-hmm. or at least they don't fit the patterns that you use for a computer.
I don't know. I guess if I put on my pessimistic hat, I think for that zeitgeist of getting excited about what technology can do leads a lot of people into working long hours and writing code mm-hmm. that then collects people's data, takes advantage of people's motivations, and makes money from them. Like, if you think about the large success stories, all of them are making a space that gets people excited, and with that, selling to them or selling them as a commodity to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm normally a relatively optimistic person. I do believe there's that other quality of the network. I do like the idea that people are less isolated in the world and that the world seems smaller now, that we have better communication, all these wonderful positive things about it. But when I hear from the people that I think are really impressive in that space, they're not the people in charge of big companies. They're the people that watched and helped it make it happen, but aren't in control of the money in the environment. That wasn't their motivation. So you have this kind of split of power in tech.
Yes. I also think in terms of the comments made by people like Mark Zuckerberg, where he was talking about the ability to bring people together and have these communities where people can talk online and share information. And Facebook's not the only one. I mean, this also happened on Twitter. It happened mm-hmm. on other platforms. But
not that Twitter's really ever made any money. But
that divide between the liberal and conservative, like when they tracked it, I saw some graphs. I'll have to look them up some other time. But it was tracking what it looked like in 1992, mm-hmm. for example, when Bill Clinton was first elected, where, yes, there were definitely two humps on the graph that referred to liberal and conservative, and they were not the same. There was a great deal of overlap. There was a continuum.
Mm-hmm. People had conservative perspectives on some things and liberal perspectives on other things, and they weren't completely diametrically opposed on all issues.
You have these two mounds. You have the extremes on both, like the people who are more liberal, more conservative within the Democratic Party, and more liberal, more conservative in the Republican Party.
And they were overlapping.
And the humps, the peaks of the humps were relatively close to one another. Mm-hmm. And so you had a whole lot of overlap where the—
Not like a Dr. Seuss camel, but more like a real camel.
The liberal conservatives had a lot of overlap with the conservative Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the same methodology today after our most recent election. And you see two humps that have very little overlap.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very there's very little in terms of common ground. Everyone has kind of staked their claim and you're not talking to each other anymore. And
do you think that's a side effect of like-minded people being able to communicate more effectively online and have their own bubble?
Yes. I believe that, and a lot of research actually backs this up, that conservatives tend to isolate themselves from other news sources a lot more than liberals do. I don't believe that liberals have moved very far left. I believe the right has moved very far to the right.
Hmm.
There are some liberals, you know, and I can probably consider myself that as well, that are pushing more for things like universal health care. Although I do have a Republican friend of mine in Montana who's also for it too, so you know, there's a give and take. But the fact that we now have conversations online where the game Wolfenstein, mm-hmm. The new revision of it, where it was about, you know, fighting Nazis, and this one is updated graphics and it's set in America as though Nazis had won, you know, mm-hmm. kind of a Man in the High Castle type of thing, but you have to fight the Nazis. 10 years ago, if you had said out and about, Nazis are bad, stop the Nazis,
there wouldn't be a conversation.
There's no conversation. People are like, yeah, of course, like that's just accepted. And now, because they said, you know, like, you got to take out the— I forgot what the actual tagline was, but they did it before. They had already been working on the game for quite some time. They had no idea of the political ramifications of it, but they were basically saying, like, we got to take the country back from the Nazis. And now you have a whole bunch of people who are coming at them saying, how dare you politicize this? What are you talking about with Trump? What are you doing? That are actually defending the term Nazi.
Right.
And it's mind-blowing to me.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Miles Elam, and we're talking about technology and society, as we do on this program. Let's talk now about the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You have two stories about this, but first let me start by saying that I just went and saw Mark Felt, the man who took down the White House. Mark Felt is commonly known as Deep Throat in the Nixon-era administration, and this is a pseudo-documentary about Mark Felt. I have a personal connection with Mark Felt because I grew up with his grandson. In fact, in the film, we're watching the film. It's hard to see because it's in... Though what they say, Rotten Tomatoes says it's on Amazon, which is interesting. I wonder if that's really true. It's in movie theaters now, kind of limited release. It's starring Neeson? What's his last name, his first name?
Liam Neeson,
thank you. And I enjoyed the film, but one of the reasons I enjoyed the film is he's looking through and he's trying to find his daughter Joan, who is my friend's mom and I know her and all that. And he's looking through these pieces of paper because she's like missing and there's all these addresses. And one of the addresses that shows up is right next door to where we are right now because we're recording in Boulder Creek. And Camp Joy is right on our border of the property I'm in. And Camp Joy, Boulder Creek, California is right in this film. It was kind of fun. And then a minute later, 1000 Alba Road, which is the house that you and I both used to live at, it's called something else now, but at the time it was 1000 Alba. It was a hippie commune, and sure enough, Mark Felt, who was the executive director of the FBI, and traveled to our neck of the woods to go meet his grandson and pick up his daughter, Joan. Anyway, really fun film from a really connected to my life kind of space, but also fascinating to see kind of the shocked perspective of these FBI agents learning what the administration is really like. Nixon administration, right? We all know how that story ends. But seeing the film, the thing is it's a little heavy-handed in the sense that kind of the entire time everyone in the know is in the know. Like they all know what's going on. And I'm just thinking of like, will we see the same thing, you know, in 30 years when about the Trump administration and what was going on with the colluding with the Soviet Union or Russia, excuse me, backing up there in the Nixon era. And whether that there are people in that space that are feeling the same way as the room is in this film about the Nixon administration. So it's kind of neat to see that kind of flashback. But I'm also thinking about how it's clearly highly political even then, right? The reason why Mark Felt decided to talk to the press secretly and then, you know, not claim about it forever and anything because he was so shocked and disgusted about what was going on. He decided to do something about it, even though it was completely against his you know, training and his idea of the country, because what these people were doing was so bad, he decided to break the rules, right? And he was actually prosecuted for other things, too. He also was in charge and partially involved with in illegally wiretapping people in the 60s, you know, hippies in the 60s that were rising up and bombing and things of that nature, right? So he went ahead and did wide sweeps without warrants and was actually prosecuted for that. And then Reagan went ahead and, what is it when you recuse a prison?
Pardoned?
Pardoned him. So I don't know if he ever served any time. I never met that guy. But in any case, it's an interesting story. I don't know if it's an amazing film, but I'm just wondering what it's like in the large bureaus, in the staff situation, the non-political people's jobs to help with the policing of our society in this day and age. So what is FBI complaining about right now?
It's the same story they've been complaining about for a while, which is not being able to break into modern cell phones anymore. The encryption is too good. So they've got almost 7,000 devices that they go, we're pretty sure the person has done bad things, and we're pretty sure that there would be evidence on the phone to get it, and we got a warrant to be able to look at it, but we can't get on the device.
You know, a year ago, I'd be really against the idea of any kind of ability for the law enforcement to get into these devices, because this idea that once you put a backdoor into a security protocol, you completely destroy the security protocol. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm much more in the space of thinking about this problem space from a society perspective. And at some point, we'll have lie detectors that are really good, right? We'll have brain scan lie detectors. Okay. The human brain, I mean, my perspective, the human brain is a complicated machine, but we get to know more about it all the time. So,
if you're not a sociopath.
Sure. But that will be detectable as well. So the question, like right now, if you had a home at your house, if you had a safe at your house and it was completely locked and there were things in it and you said, hey, it's just the data I have. It's just logs of the things I know. There's nothing, there's no guns, there's no, direct threat of a person. It's just my address books and other things of that nature. If a police officer came to a judge and said, hey, at Miles's house, we're pretty sure there's documentation in there about criminal activity that he's doing. Can we get a warrant for the safe? And the judge looks at the case and goes, yeah, Miles isn't very trustworthy. Let's do that. And says, yes, then the police can go. And even if you don't give them the combination, they can break into the safe. They can physically destroy the safe to get to the paperwork. That's completely accepted in our society in every single way, assuming that everyone did their job legally and rights and stuff were respected. But when it comes to these little electronic devices, you're talking earlier about the Silicon Valley ethos, if you will. All of us geeks think, no, it's you can't break that. It's really bad. But the truth is, we haven't really looked at how we could set up a situation that would be safe and valid to look into.
This is a funny thing. When you talked about the safe and they can just break it, if you spend a sufficient amount of money, you can have a vault or a safe that is essentially unbreakable. Like if you tried to break into it, it has a tripwire that destroys the
stuff inside
or something like that.
That's an interesting idea.
But that is limited to if you have wealth and means to be able to procure this and deal with that. So what I see is different now is you have something that anyone could have. Like everyone has the access to that safe. So what happens to that technology without having to be rich.
Well, let's talk about for a second the idea that you could have a physical protection of stuff of yours that would destroy it if somebody tried to attack it. I agree that it would be relatively – you could build something like that. It would be expensive. I think that the mathematical possibility of breaking into the physical object is better than the mathematical possibility of breaking into the electronic object. So it's still
quite possible, yeah.
There's a different level of feasibility, right? You just have to spend more time and resources to counteract the physical device. But also because you're right that because the physical device is so difficult to build, no one builds them, and everyone has the phone, there is a more democratized aspect of that, granted. And also I think that the hiding of stuff is more likely successful if you have a lot of means as well. So even if you didn't have a physical safe that was good, whatever, you could have a secret deposit box in a secret location because you've spent a lot of resources to hide the trail to hide that information. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now it's cheap and easy and everybody has it even if they don't want it.
Right. And that comes into a question of prior to this, prior to cell phones back in the day, you had more of the investigation to try to get something. Like Al Capone was taken down not because of they found evidence of him, ordering the hits on people, but because they got his accountant,
right,
and got that information. It does make me wonder, like, our concern about making sure that we can break into these phones is to make sure that it goes along with that idea of let's make sure that no one can get away with a crime. But there is always a flip side to this. If you can break into a phone, just like with wiretaps, like we do say in our country that you are not allowed to have a wiretap. Law enforcement is not supposed to put a wiretap on unless they have a court order, unless they have a warrant. And at the same time, we have decades of experience of here are a whole bunch of wiretaps that have been put on without a court order.
Right. I just mentioned Mark Felt in the Nixon era.
Right. I think of MLK. I think of the AT&T closet that grabbed all the information that went through it. Things like that where I wonder if our ethos might be a little bit off to say like, yeah, we're going to accept this, that they can't break into the phone because – if we have to make the trade-off, where are we going to draw that line to make sure that no one can get away with anything or that we respect privacy and you have to find other means.
I get that.
That's oversimplistic. Yeah. And I'm not trying to say this as like I have everything figured out. I really don't. Mm-hmm. But
no, I think it's an interesting question about that. I mean, I think that's definitely like whether we can trust people to do the right thing at some level. But I think that it's a better society if we do have in place a system of governance and police forcing that we can trust. I'd rather work to that end. The desire, the FBI director right now, right? Is it the FBI director? Who is it saying that we need access to these things? Who's actually?
Yes, it is the FBI director by the name of Christopher Wray.
Okay, and he's saying this is really a kind of a problem. We have all these thousands of devices we can't get into. We think there's 7,000 devices. We think that there's information that would help our cases here, and we can't do it.
Right. From a law enforcement point of view, from his job standpoint,
yes,
it is absolutely a huge, huge problem.
Yeah.
And there's a question of, like, is his ability to do his job, like have his job be easier, is that the same metric that the rest of us are using?
Well, let me ask you this, because I think that when the first idea of a backdoor came in, a lot of us geeks strongly suggested how bad it would be. But very infrequently that I hear really interesting conversations about how you would actually achieve a safe level of backdoor access. There is ways of doing this, right? I mean, you could have Apple manage keys that they could do things. I mean, first off, Apple does manage keys. Apple already has a process in place for doing exactly what we're talking about.
Yes.
They allow the operating system to be updated. So anytime they want, they can put an updated operating system on the phone. And when they do that, that operating system can do things like every time you encrypt your you know, thumbprint and access unencrypt data on the drive, take a copy of it and send it to Apple.
Like, right.
They could do that.
And the San Bernardino shooter, they would wait for a sync up to iCloud and then capture that data as it was in transit.
Yes.
And so there were.
Yeah. So there are possibilities of Apple doing this. Apple doesn't want to be in this business. At the same time, it seems to me that it would make more sense for Apple to say, well, here's the way we would do it, and here's the bad side and the good side of doing this. Hey, people of the United States, what do you think? Now, of course, the people of the United States, what do you think from a legal perspective, of course, is our Congress and you know, our House of Representatives. And I think that the technical problem is pretty severe, and I would be concerned about the legal ramification of making the decision from a non-technical perspective. But if Apple is just saying you can't do it, they're lying. They can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the wrong stance for them to be saying, I can't do it, because I think that will lead to a draconian bad decision.
Well, to say you can't do it, is it technically possible to put a backdoor in? Of course that's possible. Can you do it in such a way that you have safeguards against the people who have the keys? That's where the question comes into play.
Right, but I think that you and I, you know, a year ago, were saying, nope, it's impossible. Once you do that mathematically, you're just screwed. And I don't think that's true. I don't believe that anymore. I believe that it is a balance point of what is possible and what risk you incur by adding a backdoor. And also, I think right now, because Apple controls the operating system and controls the app updates, though I, you know, as a developer myself, I don't have those turned on to auto update. A lot of people do. In fact, I recommend it because it's nice just always have the most secure vulnerabilities patched.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have auto updating on your phone, you get those. As a developer, I don't do that because I actually want to control my steps in progress so that I can make sure I have a device that has a low operating system so I can test on it, all that kind of stuff. But I think that the general person, if they're not watching it and not managing it, it's much better for it to be auto done. And since it's auto done, the individual is not involved at all in what gets pushed. And Apple knows what phone you have, and they can make a modified system, and they can push it. Apple already has the ability to do exactly what the backdoor threat is. They can do it already. There's nothing legal about it at all. They can just do whatever they want.
It depends. Because there is the secure enclave on the phone. If someone does use the APIs to use the thumbprint scanner or the Face ID
That's all based on the operating system putting it in a circular enclave and making sure that it's encrypted without a second key. The operating system, when it says, hey, encrypt this, let me have the enclave, it could encrypt it twice on the disk. One that can read, one that persists to read without the enclave, and one the enclave. Now, they're not doing that, but there's no reason they couldn't. It's true that once the phone's encrypted and you haven't unlocked it and the operating system was valid, at that point, Apple pushing something on is actually problematic. They
I don't mean for unlocking. I mean in things like my bank apps. They are a separate Touch ID.
Yes.
That data and the ability to encrypt data through that mechanism.
They've designed it very well to make it difficult to do this. What I'm saying is if a warrant came about and said, hey, we want to be able to access Miles' bank data. We'll just use the bank app, right? Mm-hmm. On Miles' phone. Please get us access. Apple could modify a patch to the operating system, send it to your phone if you have auto updates going. Mm-hmm. Next time you unlocked, when that happened, they could then not re-encrypt it. Like they could then make it be accessible via their operating system.
Yes.
It would require you to be involved as part of the process. But that's kind of my point is that there are ways Apple can do this. They're not interested in doing that. They've said no and all those things. But because they're not providing a very good alternative, you're going to have this kind of raise of concern over and over and over again, and possibly if you want to work in the United States, you have to implement this, which could be an extremely bad pattern for security purposes.
Apple has also said that while they are against the intrusive, the last time I remember them arguing against it was having this requirement be put onto their business to have to make the whole development line without being compensated by the government to say, we want this, so we're going to pay you to put the extra people on it.
I think that's a completely lame response. I mean, the reason I think that's a lame response is that granted, it's true that they can complain that in that way, but, you know, they also have to pay taxes. I mean, there's things they don't want to do that government forces them to do all the time. I mean, there's tons of that going on. So the idea that, oh, no, you have to reinforce – well, no, the government doesn't have to do that. All the government has to do is say, hey, everyone that sells phones in the United States has to have a back door that we have access to. And then, boom, Apple has to do it, and they have to incur the cost. That's the downside of doing business in the United States, right? So that's
true.
It's a political maneuver to say, oh, it's too hard. And I think it's kind of a weak one. I think a better response –
They didn't say it was too hard. They said
– well, they said it's hard and it would be expensive for us to do it.
Yeah, they wanted
– yeah. Complaints of Apple making complaints that something's expensive for them to do is ridiculous. They have more; they're the most profitable company in the world, right? Anyway, so I think that's a silly way to argue the problem. I think a better way to argue the problem is: what, as a society, do we want to have secret and have individuals have control over, and what do we not?
Mm-hmm.
We have written in our Constitution that with no search and seizure without just cause or whatever
without a warrant. Yeah,
effectively, you basically say, let's trust some people to make wise decisions in society. Let's not make them part of law enforcement. Let's make them the judges that decide this, and then a process in place to make sure that occurs. And if Apple were to really invest in that problem space, they could come up with a conclusion that we'd all feel pretty good about, I think.
Yeah, I guess my thought process is also in terms of law enforcement saying this is a huge, huge problem. And law enforcement in general saying X, Y, or Z is making it harder to do our jobs.
Yes.
Because taking it to the logical other extreme is the Bill of Rights makes it harder for law enforcement. It would be a lot easier for law enforcement to function if they didn't have to worry about the Fourth Amendment. It would be a lot easier for them to get a conviction to find out information if there wasn't a Fifth Amendment. That there are aspects that, it's not beholden upon society to make it easy for law enforcement.
I agree,
This isn't to say that I want to be against law enforcement. I don't think it should be getting any tools to be able to solve it. But I think this is – I mean, obviously from our conversation, like this is an open question. Like where is that line drawn?
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting that the technology that we've also seen in the last 20 years, 10 years, whatever, of everybody having a device that's always connected to a network that tracks your location. Because really, if you've got a mobile phone and you don't have it in airplane mode – and actually, the new operating system, if you have it on airplane mode, basically your location's known, and those are warrantable. So, yes, it's annoying that you can't get into people's devices, but you also know where everybody is all the time, law enforcement. Right. So, come on. I mean, the technology helps them also in some of their jobs. Additionally, you know, high tech helps in general in law enforcement in all these myriad of other ways. You get a fingerprint now, you know who that person is, most likely, right? There's DNA analysis. There's all these other things. License plate readers. License plate tracking systems that are automated and know where all cars are all the time in most cities. That's a thing. That just happens now. So, yeah, some things are harder, but some things are a lot easier. I don't know. Let's cover one more story before we say goodnight. Why don't you tell me about, two-factor authentication? Can we just skip to that one?
Yeah, something we don't talk about too much with two-factor authentication, that being you either get a text to your phone or you use a secure, you know, one-time pad to fill in after the fact. So it's not just you on a site with your username and your password. You have to have a physical device like your phone to get it. Now, we've talked about security vulnerabilities with regard to text messages because people have, you know, done some social engineering to be able to get a phone number transferred over, and you can get, you know, a text sent to you when you weren't supposed to, and then you get access to an account, things like that. But what we haven't talked about as yet are all these times where a company has had their has been hacked and their database has been taken, because there you have passwords, and if the company is doing their job correctly, the passwords have been hashed.
Yes.
So it's not the plain text password, and it may take a fair amount of processing power to actually get something usable out of it.
Yeah.
The issue is with two-factor, because two-factor, you can't hash it in the database. You have to have a model that you can then compute against for that second factor to come in with a challenge.
Right. So the general way two-factor works from a mathematical perspective is that you have a key, and both parties have this key, and doing some math on that key with time will produce a known number to the two of them. So that way, effectively, I can say, here's my token, and you can compute and go, yeah, that token seems to fit, right? Right. And it's basically a time-based thing, correct?
It's tied to time, yeah. Yeah.
So it doesn't work such that I give the code, you enter that in your algorithm, and you get a positive. It's more like you and I match codes at the same time, effectively.
Right.
Okay, got it. So if my entry of what my two-factor authentication token actually is, that secret piece that allows me to calculate the number, is known by an attacker, they can now be me.
Right, and that would be stored in the database along with the password.
Sure, but also they have the password hashed, which means they don't have the password.
Right, but we've always talked about how, like, oh, the password is the hard part. And now it's like the two-factor, if you have things in place like Experian, you have places like Target, you know, that have been hacked, if they were using two-factor, the fact that you were using two-factor when they got hacked was not a protection at all.
Right.
And the fact that there are so many of these companies getting hacked in such catastrophic ways means that all of the extra protections and all the extra trouble that we have been going through
does nothing.
Does nothing. Yeah. It is effectively mitigated.
All right. Let's try to just parse that again quickly. So there's some site I'm going to log into. I have two-factor authentication. So I have to have a password and I have to enter it in. Mm-hmm. And I get it. My phone is generating a number that they can match.
Mm-hmm.
So that all of a sudden makes it so much more realistic that this login is me.
Mm-hmm.
However, if the entire database is scraped, and some without them knowing about it, now a person has my two-factor authentication token, and all they need is my password, which they might be able to get from me from other means, like tricking me and stuff like that. So you're right that it's still a benefit to have two-factor authentication. You shouldn't toss it. It's still beneficial, but it doesn't protect you against these mass data breaches.
Well, let's think about the sending a text message with the second factor. Well, you've got the database, and you now have the phone number that you would need to be able to text for that second factor.
Right.
You now have the target model to say, okay, if I do a rainbow table, in other words, you're trying the most common passwords, and if you try it on a very large database,
you'll get positives.
You're going to get a whole lot of because people are terrible at passwords. And you also have the phone number that's associated with, which is itself already an extra security breach because now it's like, oh, now I have this other tying information. If you have two separate databases, you now have more information about who that person is.
Yeah.
And totally. Then moving on to like
have you heard of the solution to this? Squirrel? Do you know about Squirrel? This protocol? I think I've talked to you about it before. I'm really excited about it. It's kind of pending. I don't know if it'll be adopted. But the general concept is that you have on your device a private key, public key encryption system. And when a website wants to get a password from you, they show you a giant number, which you then produce a proof that you are the owner of the private key. So they have a public key of you. They generate a number. You look at the domain name that they're at, and you look at this number that they've generated. You then sign those and send it back to them with your private key. You send back an acknowledgement on a second channel to them, and they now know that the code they just showed you was seen by you, and then you're logged in. So effectively, all that's being saved in the database of who you are is your public key. It's a cool pattern. It's a work in progress. Gibson Research works on it. They make SpinRite, and Steve Gibson is a really cool podcaster as well. In any case, that methodology would alleviate some of this.
As would U2F, which is a little dongle. YubiKey is the company that makes that.
Well, that's just two-factor authentication, though. That's just a secret token that the other company has, right?
It is, but it's a hardware device that is dedicated to it. There is a public key, private key pair involved there.
Yeah, but the public key, but the nonce generating code has to be at YubiKey as well, right? They have to know what your code is. It's the same problem. Assuming you trust YubiKey to keep their database safe, hopefully you do.
You mean keep the database that's stored on the device? Because YubiKey doesn't have any knowledge about it. It's all on the USB dongle.
But no, what's on the USB dongle that's actually generating a code is just equivalent to you have to then verify that code's valid. A second party has to verify that code is valid.
Right, but it is using public key, private key encryption as far as I'm aware. So that
the problem space is still the same.
The site would still have the public key and you would have the private key.
Oh, no, I didn't think so. Oh, you're talking about the new YubiKey keys patterns. The newer YubiKey devices, not the old number generators.
Oh, no, not okay. The old number generators. Gotcha, I'm talking gotcha. About
the
ones,
new ones
that,
yeah.
Yeah, I remember
a second pass authentication.
I showed
flow.
It to you when I used to work for Google, sure. The little gold thing where you just touch the side and.
Right, and that does do a similar thing of a private key, private key. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and his user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like, just have to give us credit. Today's title of this show is Go Modem Divides FBI into Two Factors. I'm Lyle Troxell, and today I was speaking with Miles Elam, and our theme song is by Michael Newman, and our title for today is by Greg Merkley, and I appreciate the support from people. Also, I appreciate the support of our patrons. If you want to support us, you can go to geekspeak.org/support. Miles Elam, thank you so much for being here on GeekSpeak.
Always a pleasure.
Did you have any post show you wanted to do?
Yeah. There's a wonderful Twitter feed.
What Twitter feed?
At GamerTakes, GAMER takes, TAKES, takes as in getting a zeitgeist by taking different comments made by various people. The interesting about this one is they have said, right now we're pretty much doing Wolfenstein takes for right now. It's not because the account is dedicated to Wolfenstein. It's just that's the only, I mean, it's the main thing that people are keep on going on about. Watching this account is illuminating, just watching the number of people that had come out of the woodwork. When Wolfenstein puts up an ad where it has the Lincoln Memorial, what was the Lincoln Memorial, but it has a Nazi symbol in front of it and the colors, and it uses the word resist, hashtag no more Nazis, hashtag Wolf 2. 10 years ago, that would not have been controversial.
I can't believe it's controversial now.
Yeah, and now you have people that are saying, you know, Nazi as used these days is nothing other than an anti-white slur, right? Like,
what?
Exactly. You're going like, what? This is the commonplace. This is people that think that they are being completely reasonable.
So what you're saying is there is a large population in the United States that thinks that Nazi is not a bad thing?
that Nazi is just this word that people throw around, and anti-white
is their meaning.
Is, you know, you're calling me a Nazi, but all I believe is that white people are superior. Like, it's that type of thing where it's like, it's, yes, you're right. You're not.
I don't believe in overpowering
the National Socialist Organization from the 1930s to 1940s. So there is some nuance there. But the ideology of white supremacy and that Jews are bad and, you know, like, these are all things that's what people associate with them to say, yeah, these were the major points that led to bad things.
Yeah. You actually had two more stories that were in the list. The Twitter account wasn't. By the way, if you want to follow Miles, he is at Miles Elam on Twitter, and I'm at Lyle. And Miles, you need more followers because you are awesome. You write tons of stuff.
I retweet tons of stuff. But if you're interested in databases and web technology, then yes, I'm definitely the person to follow.
I see that your paragraph that describes you on Twitter is select snippets from bio where info equals pithy, --, includes family, friends, podcast, and political views.
Yeah, --, because that's a SQL comment.
Is it --, an SQL comment?
Yeah.
I didn't remember that. That's awesome.
So the other stories were there's a attack called Crack.
With a K.
With a K. And it's a very torturous acronym that stands for Key Reinstallation Attack.
Where'd the C and the K come from?
The K is from Key. The R is from reinstallation.
The last K.
The A is from attack. CK is from the end of attack. I said
Wi-Fi security attack crack thing?
It is a weakness in WPA2.
Oh, is it a serious one?
Yeah.
Okay,
affects a lot of devices.
WPA2 is the secure form of Wi-Fi encryption for home
use. Yeah, years ago we were saying don't use WEP anymore, use WPA2. Not WPA, but WPA2.
Yes.
So this affected basically everything that runs Linux. So that included Android, most Wi-Fi routers.
So Android is the Linux derivative?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Most Wi-Fi routers. That's a problem. Because those are the things that actually are securing your...
Right. It did affect Safari to some extent, so iOS devices. But that was being mitigated. So different vendors are going on.
Safari on iOS? How can a key...
I'm sorry. iOS was affected.
Okay. So not just Linux derivatives, but Unix derivatives.
Right. Apparently, at the beginning, we're finding macOS and OpenBSD were actually easier to attack.
And they've been patched if you have auto updates going.
Right. So when the OS says that you need to update...
Do it.
Chances are it's going to be something that fixes this. As it turns out, Microsoft was not vulnerable, or at least not to the main attack, but they did have some concerns that theoretically they could be affected, so Microsoft is also releasing a patch for Windows as well.
And effectively, this was a actual proof of concept exploit done off of theoretical vulnerabilities in WPA2.
Yes.
So it was... We've always kind of known this might be possible, and someone wrote an attack that actually works.
Right.
But we're not seeing it in the wild yet.
But theoretical attacks almost always turn into practical ones, so it does need to be fixed.
If the theory is right.
Yeah.
How easy is it to circuit? So effectively, you can connect to the connection, or you can eavesdrop on Wi-Fi connections?
From what I understand, it's eavesdropping.
Okay.
But
so
I don't...
This doesn't... Yeah. I mean, assuming that you're doing the right things... Where you are using secure protocols on top of Wi-Fi, this doesn't matter necessarily as much. So right now, when you're for example, iOS, Apple has strongly suggested that developers switch to all secure traffic for images, for everything. Mm-hmm. Use HTTPS instead of normal. And it used to be that, you know, images and stuff would be served through without encryption on it.
Yeah.
And so now Apple's kind of pushing strongly all developers to go to this route where everything's SSL. So you can't, for example, use any of the iCloud protocol stuff without SSL. You can't get push notifications. The way that push and notification systems work, you have to go through, you know, you have to have a server online as well to communicate with Apple to get them, and that has to be secure. So there's a lot more embedded in. If you're connected to Facebook, if you're connected to Google, all those are using HTTPS. So at some level, even if you access GeekSpeak, you know, a site that we don't even pay for the secure circuits anymore, certificates anymore, you can access that through via secure means.
Yeah.
So theoretically, if you're doing everything right, even if this Wi-Fi problem, it's not necessarily a problem. And one of the reasons, of course, for that is that if you go to a coffee shop and you connect to the coffee shop Wi-Fi and WPA, you don't know what they're actually running. And so they could have software that was looking at your traffic anyway.
Yeah. In fairness, if you're connecting in a coffee shop, you don't even know you're connecting to the coffee shop. It could be just someone who opens up
Exactly. So you need to use protocols on top of that. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Thanks for letting me know. So update your operating systems and such. Very important. Hi, Higgs boson.
And the other one was body cams in the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
They found that of all the cams worn by 2,600 police officers, that it did not have a noticeable effect upon the use of force nor the number of citizen complaints. So as it's turning out, body cams are not actually doing any good.
Well, wait a second. They're not doing any good in the sense that, I mean, is prosecutions of police officers going up?
Not to my knowledge. That's actually another aspect. This is something I was learning about online on Twitter, as a matter of fact, that there are many clauses with police police departments and police unions have with cities that require arbitration for determining whether an officer is allowed to be back in the force or not a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
So if something happens, they have to be bound to the decision of the arbitration, which is usually just some lawyer who's been appointed to it, who, you know, paid for by whomever.
And why aren't the DAs prosecuting? Because they want to have a good relationship with the police force?
The thing is, there's a difference between whether or not something was criminally something that they would go like, yes, we have something that we're going to indict for,
or versus policy.
This was something that was just egregiously wrong, that a police officer betrayed trust. They should not be a police officer, but not necessarily go to jail. There is that continuum, and mm-hmm. that gap there is the one that is basically short-circuited.
Well, Miles, thanks for doing the news with me. It's good seeing you again.
Yeah, you too.
It was fun. All right. I'll see you next week.
Yep.